25-year-old Roger Bannister gets away at the Iffley Ground, Oxford, for the race of his life. For years, he has dreamed of becoming the first man to run the mile in less than 4 minutes. And here he comes. Bannister goes streaking forward with about 250 yards to the tapes. Just look at his action as his long legs carry him nearer that world record. And Bannister has done it. The mile in 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds.
Roger Bannister's sub-4-minute mile in 1954 may be the most iconic achievement in the history of running. But as the decades have passed and runners keep shaving more and more time off world records across the sport, Bannister breaking that barrier now feels like the easy part. Today, with the Olympic spotlight shifting to the track in Tokyo, we examine the never-ending quest to go faster, higher, stronger, and how at this point, it might actually be all about the shoes. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, July 30th. This is ESPN Daily. Presented by UKG. Our purpose is people. So, Dave, we've had you on the show before. Listeners may recall that you are my friend, that you are my former colleague at Sports Illustrated. And the reason I'm bringing you on today, among many, is that you once ran against Usain Bolt. How can we make that characterization journalistically sound?
Alongside him at a training practice, hoping to like interview him and take pictures. I guess that would be the best.
alongside the fastest human being on the planet, Dave, I feel like that does qualify as a pretty decent humble brag. And that is the topic that I wanted to talk about with you today, actually, because track and field start at the Olympics today. And when you think about the Olympics and that Latin motto, Citius, Altius, Fortius, meaning faster, higher, stronger, specifically track and field, it really is kind of this periodic barometer of the limits of physical performance, of human capability. And so I'm wondering, as somebody who studies human physical performance, who studies running and is obsessed with it specifically, is that the lens through which you view the Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, to some degree, and also just to see the differences, you know?
David Epstein is a best-selling author and, in my opinion, the best sports science writer in the world.
There's no other sporting event that's like truly global in quite this way, I would say, like not even the World Cup, because here it's global, not just geographically, but also sort of physiologically, right? Mm. You're seeing like every sort of physical niche that an athletic body can fit into. And I enjoy seeing that just sort of spectrum of humanity and what people can do and sort of tracking how that's changed over time, which is significant, by the way, extremely significant.
Yeah, well, let's talk about how things have changed over time, because to me, it doesn't seem like there's a better place to start, Dave, than with, I think, the oldest sporting event that exists at the Olympics, which, of course, has its origins in ancient Greece, and that would be the marathon. So how have times in the men's marathon, how have they progressed over the last century or so, let's say?
So in 1904, Thomas Hicks won the Olympic marathon in 3 hours, 28 minutes, and 53 seconds. Which now is like, you know, if you Googled marathon training and like one of the first results that came up and you followed it for a few months, you know, you might be able to run that. But you know, not only were people not really training that much, not only were the vast majority of people in the world not participating, which is still true, right? But at the time, there was even much less participation. But there were things like the winner was taking what he thought was a performance-enhancing drug, brandy, and strychnine, and actually, like, poisoned himself while competing.
So brandy, the alcohol, I know. Strychnine is what precisely?
It's a poison.
So literally just poison.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah, yeah. It's a, yeah. Yeah, it's a poison. That's right.
This was just a witch's brew PED back in the day?
Yeah, it was just thought, you know, that was the scientific thinking at the time, I guess, that would pump you up. Obviously, it was not like that systematic. There was none of the sort of high performance science things that go on now and none of the, you know, financial rewards and all that. It was just a totally different ballgame with none of the seriousness.
Just a dude in 1904 trying to, you know, break some records by drinking rat poison.
You know, you gotta try a little bit of everything, I guess. I don't know what that falls into, but imagine if there had been social media then. Like, he could have had Instagram ads for brandy and strychnine cocktails. Like, it would have been huge.
Absolutely. So, okay, that was 1904, a long, long time ago. How radically, I mean, things have changed very radically, but how radical are we talking here?
Basically an hour and a half radical. So the current marathon world record held by Kenyan Eliud Kipchoge is 2 hours, 1 minute, and 39 seconds.
He comes towards the line, raises a sprint on those magical legs, and at last, 2:01:40, unofficially there for Eliud Kipchoge. He breaks the world record by an astonishing margin.
And to put that in perspective, that is, I think that's 4:34 mile pace about.
Mm.
So let's say, like, if you remember your gym class mile, let's say the kid who won.
I don't want to remember my gym class mile, but
do you remember what you ran?
Dave, the first number was definitely like an 8. Just move on.
Okay. Let's say whoever won your gym class mile ran 6 flat, 6 minutes.
Yes, like they weren't the captain of the track team. Right. Brian Lorenzen, real quick. I remember him. Yes. 6 something.
Okay. So when Brian was finishing and winning your gym class mile, so sorry, when he was 3 laps through the 4 laps of your gym class mile, Kipchoge would be finishing a mile, and then he would do that times 26.2. So I would say, like, if you picked an average person off the street, I think they would not be able to keep up with his marathon pace for 30 seconds. And if you took the average pro athlete in a non-endurance sport, I don't think they would be able to keep up with it for 2 minutes.
Man, so how did we get here to the point where that fact you just laid out, which is mind-blowing and obviously humiliating for me personally, how did we get there?
But huge for Brian Lorenzen.
Yeah.
So I think a couple things have gone on. First of all, so I sort of think of records as progressing in kind of three phases, and I think the marathon is a really good case study in those phases. So first you have, right, like we talked about in 1904, where you basically have, you know, an interested amateur running and winning the Olympics, because at the time most of the world wasn't competing, and you could be like the only person who had any talent or who was doing some training, and you could win the Olympics. When the sport becomes a lot more competitive and it starts becoming globally competitive, you see, first of all, more people, right? You're more likely to get talented people, obviously. But you also start to see this, And this happened in all sports, this kind of changing of body types. So you get people who are more fit for the certain sport. So as you sort of do the global search and the sport becomes more competitive, and so times start coming down very, very quickly as you're just introducing new, more talented competitors. In this case, a specific Kenyan tribe called the Kalenjin, their population is about, you know, it's like roughly equivalent to like metropolitan Atlanta, and yet, you know, they have like more sub-210 marathoners than like all of the United States ever by a ton. And so you get these, you know, you get some of these populations that are hotspots for a variety of reasons, for talent and training principles start to evolve. And so you see this steady record progression. So you go from sort of the exploratory phase to the globally competitive phase. And then you move into what the third phase, which in the marathon, I would say started probably around 2000 or so. Mm. Where you're starting to see diminishing returns. Like, it sort of looks like you're approaching certain types of limits, and the records are coming down still, but at a decreased clip. And what happens then is that for records to keep progressing, conditions and technology need to be curated. So with the marathon, for example, the last 7 world records, so nearly 20 years worth of marathon world records, have occurred only at the Berlin Marathon, right? Before this, you could break the record. Chicago sometimes, London sometimes. Now it's only Berlin.
Wait, so hold on. So Berlin, I don't know anything about why Berlin is this magical world of record breaking. Why is that the case in marathon?
Yeah, a few factors. One, the course itself, okay, it's flat, so you're not dealing with a lot of up and downhill. There are very few tight curves, so you're not losing your stride and losing your momentum. The temperature is very mild, so it's usually like in the 50s, so you're not heat limited. And usually Berlin will invite, like, you know, one or two people who are the best in the world as opposed to a whole bunch. So there's like less emphasis on them all racing one another tactically and more on trying to run as fast as possible with the pace setters. And so I think when you get into phase three, where it's like most of the big chunks of record have been taken away, then you get into this phase where it's like, all right, now it's like conditions and technology that really start to make the difference. And those have to be very carefully curated, which is why you start to see the records only set under certain conditions.
All right, so we've determined that no matter how perfect those conditions are in Berlin for the marathon, I myself will be no threat to the world record anytime soon. I am at peace with this. But I did want to rewind, Dave, because when you mentioned world records falling and how unfathomable these times seem now, I think of what was once the holy grail of all records in sports, the most unbreakable of all of those records, arguably, that has ever existed, which was the 4-minute mile. So, remind us of the history of that milestone and how it eventually and very famously fell.
It was sort of, you know, out there, obviously, as a benchmark, but it was really, I think, post-World War II when it really became, when people were sort of closing in on it, and, you know, it was like Everest, you know, like the summiting Everest, but for track.
Man and the mile. Man against the mile, a supreme test of courage, of human will, of determination. The goal had been the 4-minute mile, the dream that had through the years beckoned the world's swiftest runner.
And the interesting thing was that competitors were getting really close to it, you know, running 4:02, 4:01, 4 flat, and not getting through it. And so that sort of led to this bit of mythology that it might be kind of a magical barrier beyond which, like, humans simply could not go. But that was never the opinion of Sir Roger Bannister, who was a medical student at the time.
Roger Bannister limbers up for a planned attack on that 4-minute mile never before achieved by man.
And felt very strongly that 3:59.9 and 4:01 were, you know, no different than any other fraction of a second difference. And so he was the first in 1954 to run a sub-4-minute mile.
Up to the finishing line. Time, 3 minutes, 59.4 seconds, shattering the 4-minute mile, the Everest of athletic achievement. A great reception for the young medical student who had cut 2 whole seconds off Gunter Hag's world record set up 9 years ago.
Well, and Dave, and you know, running alongside Usain Bolt is one thing. You're also one of the few people, well, you're the only person that I know who actually, like, hung out with Roger Bannister at one point too, right?
That's right. At Sports Illustrated, I did a Where Are They Now story on him, and we sort of became friendly. Because after, I mean, the interesting thing about Bannister, he retired from running at the age of 25 and went on to become a world-renowned neurologist.
As one does.
As one does, that's right. But yeah, you know, he's a titanic figure in the sport, obviously, because that was such an interesting barrier. And once he broke it, then it was like, you know, people started breaking it left and right. And so it did seem to have this effect of, like, shattering some psychological barrier, you know, or blazing that trail that other people then walked.
So how many people can run a sub-4 mile today, and why?
I mean, I don't know what the latest count is, but you know, if you go to the top tier college track meets every year, people are going to be breaking 4. In the last few years, we've had a few high school kids do it, right? It's like, if you're not running sub-4, you're not even in contention for a college national championship anymore, maybe not even for the college finals in many cases. So it is much, much more common now, and including it occurs in, you know, sometimes with teenage boys.
And the why, though, the why they can do this, is that a matter of conditions mostly? Is it a matter of the human body improving in ways? What's your understanding of that?
I think it's multifaceted. And I should say, by the way, someone running sub-4 mile, I just made it sound kind of common. It's still extraordinarily fast. Like, you're still one of the best runners in the world.
You don't have to tell me that, Dave.
Okay.
Mr. 8-something does not need to be reminded that a sub-4 is impressive.
Got it. Okay. But yeah, so I think there are a couple things. The conditions are certainly a difference. Right now, even high school kids are running with shoes that are made to return more energy to their feet, and they're running on synthetic surfaces that are specifically created to make you faster. But also Bannister, I mean, serious high school kids are training more seriously than Bannister was at that point. And he took off like weeks before the record attempt. He decided to, like, stop training and go hiking in the Alps to get rejuvenated. Probably not what you would advise for someone making a record attempt.
Yeah, better than the rat poison, but not ideal.
I mean, I think the morning of the sub-4 mile, he was doing like some like OBGYN rounds, you know, because he was a med student, like literally that same day, you know, and then he goes and runs on a cinder track. You know, this is basically like gravel, which is a lot slower. So I think, again, even a lot of high school kids now are training in a more professional way than top athletes were then. There's certainly a lot more people competing in a lot better conditions. But I think really that initial phase of big record breaking, again, comes down to, in some ways, marketing. Like, you market the sport, you get a much larger number of competitors. Mm. I mean, when I think of the U.S. college system, where I was a Division I 800 meter runner, the U.S. college system probably supports 20, 30, maybe even more thousand young adults in training that is more serious than almost anyone in the world was doing, you know, a half century ago, basically. And obviously that has a huge impact.
So the mile as a record today, Dave, where are we given the world that Roger Bannister has birthed?
Yeah, the current record is 3:43, which obviously is unbelievably fast. But it was set by a Moroccan man named Hisham El Gharouj in 1999.
Nayan trying to move in on Hicham El Gharouj. He's closing. Watch the time. The world record, 3:44.39. They race to the finish line. Hicham El Gharouj is going to hang on. He's got a world record, 3:43.12.
And so this is a case where a record has, you know, was being broken frequently, at increasingly small margins, and has now been stuck for over 20 years. And so, you know, I think we will see it broken. I think we may well see it broken soon, but not by much, right? So this is one that seems like it is, it's...
Yeah, why is that one stuck in the way that it is?
In the middle distance events, there've still been some record breaking occurring, but it has been few and far between. So the same thing in the 800 meters, the half mile, where I think we're just getting closer to the limit. And again, I always give the caveat that the limit, technological changes happen that can totally change what that limit looks like. But I think you're into the phase where technological tweaks will make more difference than adding more humans to the event.
So let's get to the marquee event of these games. Because if you know nothing else about the Olympics, you probably still know about the 100-meter dash, where we crown the fastest human being on the planet. You probably have heard about Usain Bolt, of course, a 3-time Olympic champion out of Jamaica, the current world record holder. But, you know, I'm curious how Bolt does stack up historically when you compare him to, like, Jesse Owens, who won the event, won the 100, famously, historically, at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin.
You know, Usain Bolt, I think, is the best 100-meter runner that's ever competed, but not by the margin that people might think. But Jesse Owens, like, if you go back and look at that video.
Jesse Owens was the fastest human of his day, and he took both the 200 and 100-meter titles. Here's his lightning-like form as he captures the 100-meter in 10.3 seconds.
He literally had his a gardening, like a trowel that you would use to like weed if you have a garden, to dig holes to put his feet in for the starting blocks, right? So think about the difference between that and like these very well calibrated blocks that people use now, right? And they have like a horn right behind them, so they hear the sound really quickly when the gun goes off and all those sorts of things. And
I just like how yard work was a prerequisite for competing in this race once upon a time.
That's right. And then he was running on cinders, again, which is a soft surface. It's sort of gravelly, but it's often made out of like burnt wood chips, basically. And that, you know, it's not quite running on the beach, but we can use that analogy. If you've run on the beach before, you're probably not going to set your best 100-meter time compared to if you run on a solid surface. And so, you know, there was an analysis of Jesse Owens' joint speed that suggested he would have been, you know, more like the speed of Carl Lewis, even though his time was much slower because the conditions were just very different. So I still think Usain Bolt is the best and unbelievable. But even in something as simple as the 100 meters, I think people underestimate how much technological change has mattered.
So what I'm hearing from you, given all of this, is that, yes, humanity keeps getting better and better, keeps optimizing, all of that is so, but the technology, the training, the other stuff that human beings have figured out on top of the physiology, it seems like that is more to do with this than like a phenomenon of actual like physical evolution.
Yeah, and I think that's especially true when you're into the record-breaking phase three, like the small margins period, where you've got a lot of people in the sport, you know, the basic training principles are known. And so then it's these sort of other things that make small differences.
All right, Dave, after the break, I want to get deeper into that phenomenon. I want to look at some of the more recent changes that are causing records to fall and how technology is tied in that way to human achievement.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So today, Dave, track and field is about to start. It is your time. What are some of the records that could possibly fall that you're monitoring, and why would they be falling this year in particular?
You know, I think it's unlikely that they'll fall at the Olympics, because usually the Olympics is more tactical. Like, you care more about winning than running a fast time. But it does happen. And this past 2 years really have been sort of an epic time of record breaking, including some records that stood for a long time, like the 5,000 and 10,000 meters were both broken in 2020. And I think one thing that's on the mind of everyone who's sort of involved in running geekery, like I am, is a change in shoes. So going back to the 2016 Olympics in Rio, I didn't know this at the time, but all three medalists in the men's marathon and the winner, at least the winner of the women's marathon, were all wearing these Nike prototype shoes called the Vaporfly that at the time were sort of disguised, if you will, so that people didn't know that they were something new. But now basically everyone has to have them, to the extent where some athletes who are endorsed by brands who have not made these certain special types of shoes have started letting their athletes wear shoes from other companies because the performance advantage big deal.
This is something that I need to understand. So what are these shoes? How do they work? Because for so long, Dave, we get all of this BS from shoe companies that it's got to be the shoes. But in this case, it sounds like it's actually got to be the shoes.
So there are two main things. There's this foam on the bottom of the shoe that is made to act sort of like a spring, like where you compress it when you step down. And if it stores energy really efficiently, if it's both light on your foot and stores energy and can return that energy to your foot, right, when you're coming off the ground, sort of in a spring-like way. And these shoes also have carbon fiber plates in the sole that I actually thought would also act like a spring, but it turns out some of the physics that's been done on that shows that's not the case, and that they are, some of how their work is maybe a little mysterious, but some of it is that they kind of add stiffening to your foot. So maybe, you know, things like your big toe, which you use to push off, like won't bend as much and waste energy while doing that because it'll be held in a stiffer position. Some of it's a little mysterious, but certainly there's this energy return of the foam and these carbon fiber plates that are in shoes that basically you now have to wear if you want to be competitive. And so all the shoe companies have been developing them. But now we're moving on to the next level, where in Tokyo, it's not just road racing shoes, but we're seeing them for track spikes, and that's kind of the new thing that's still a little mysterious, but that I think is causing some of the times that we're seeing.
Wow. So if basically what you're telling me is that if I want to finally challenge Brian Lorenzen,
yes,
I got to go get a pair of these shoes.
Yes. And now every company has had to keep up. So all the companies. So there's been a shuffling sometimes of athletes who have left certain companies if they don't provide those shoes, or companies have let the athletes wear shoes from other companies. And you're sort of seeing things that are that for, again, people that really follow running raises your eyebrow, like at the Olympic trials, the U.S. Olympic trials recently, you know, in the 1500 meters, which is basically the mile, all three of the top finishers were New Balance and wearing the same New Balance shoes. And so, you know, who knows? That could happen anyway. But I think everyone's sort of curious about the shoes now. Like, one of the most impressive performances in running that I can ever think of was Usain Bolt ran 19.9 in the 200 meters when he was 17 years old to set a world junior record. And that was just shattered by Arian Knighton at the U.S. Olympic trials, who's 17 years old. And when I saw that, I'm like, man, this is just outlandish. Like, these shoes, I think, are adding performance benefit on par with like some of the major doping drugs, essentially. Wow. So you kind of have to have them if you want to compete now. And I think it's going to be a real haves and have now. There's a rule supposed to be, shoe technology is supposed to be barred if it's not reasonably available to all athletes in the competition. And I think these are, certainly when we're talking about global competition, are violating that principle, but it's being allowed.
But it sounds like the science at this point, Dave, around these shoes is indisputable. But what is clearly in dispute, and I know you're like, you know, a reader of track message boards and stuff, is the integrity of these accomplishments. How does Usain Bolt feel about this? How do other runners, maybe more purists, how do they feel about the fact that this technology, as you say, is perhaps more effective than actual PEDs?
Yeah, I mean, the real running geeks are probably tired of hearing about it at this point, because what can you do? And I don't want to be a Luddite about it. Like, there's always been technological advances. At the same time, to me, this one feels a little different in the sense that, you know, again, in 2016, when these shoes were making an impact, they were sort of disguised and you didn't really know. And so I think it's, and I don't think it's true that they're reasonably available to all athletes. And again, not to be anti-technology whatsoever, but I think one cool thing about track and field is that it is one of the very small number of sports that isn't so equipment intensive that most of the world has no opportunity to even participate at a high level.
Right.
And so I think it's a bit of a bummer when that happens. And also, you asked about Usain Bolt. I mean, I think he rightly has said, you can't really compare my records, even though he still has the world records in the 100 and 200, to people who are now wearing these shoes with like spring-like foam and carbon plates, because they obviously make a big difference. So it's kind of a bummer that it makes it hard to compare to him.
So when we're watching these races, Dave, and we're trying to figure out which records might fall, how commonplace are these shoes going to be?
I think they're going to be essentially ubiquitous for the people who are in contention to win, because I think they won't be in contention to win without them.
And who are the runners that we may see on the medal stand who, if you pan down just a little bit, you'll see this technology?
Trayvon Bermell in the 100 meters, Noah Lyles in the 200 meters. So these are American favorites in the 100 and 200. Gabby Thomas, who made a big splash at the Olympic trials. She's the Harvard grad who made a big splash at the U.S. Olympic trials. I think she runs for New Balance, but, you know, is wearing these kinds of shoes. Arian Knighton, the 17-year-old who broke Usain Bolt's world junior 200-meter record. So you'll see them everywhere.
Well, all of this reminds me, Dave, of like the controversy technologically that we had with those swimsuits, right? That swimmers were wearing in Beijing, right? In 08.
It's track and field's laser suit moment. No question about it.
Meet the new spacesuit from Speedo. The Laser Racer, an ultrasonically welded, ultra-low-friction suit that actually repels water.
Except swimming, I think, made the wise decision to say, like, look, these are clearly not reasonably available to everyone, and they make a huge difference. You know, it was, like, proven in, like, NASA, like, did, like, friction experiments on it and stuff. And so they barred them, which, again, I think technological advancement is part of the creativity that is involved, the human creativity that's involved in sports. And I love it to a certain extent. But again, it's not reasonably available to everyone. There's a lot that's not known about it. And so in that sense, I think it is sort of violating some of the spirit of the competition. And track and field decided, you know, not to go the way of swimming and ban this. And I think there's a lot of, this is total speculation, but there's certainly been a lot of talk in the running community about the current head of World Athletics, which is the governing body for track and field, when he became the head of World Athletics, was still like a paid brand ambassador for Nike. And I think there have been a lot of questions of, had this not started with Nike, would it still be going? And that's pure speculation, but it is certainly a message board topic, if you will, in the running community.
So it sounds like, from what you're saying, Dave, that humanity is starting to just plateau a bit. I mean, we've made the big jumps, the big improvements in world record times that we've been able to. And from here on out, you're saying that those little tiny improvements in technology or training techniques, that's going to make the difference going forward. Is that right?
You know, I think it depends on the sport, because I think people probably generally overestimate the global competitiveness of most sports, right? Like, I think people realize that, say, like, a competitor in dressage, like, it helps if you're, you know, Mike Bloomberg's daughter or whatever.
or Mitt Romney's daughter, in fairness.
Yeah, right. So that, but in the other sports, it's still true that most people in the world don't have real access to training in most things. You know, so Australia, for example, made this huge improvement in their swimming when they were going to host the Olympics and decided to build pools all over the place. Because the fact is, very few people in the world really have access to be able to train in swimming. And so if you can give that access, that's like the biggest improvement, you know, you can make in sports. And I think most sports still have that to come. I think there's a small number of exceptions, you know, obviously soccer, some of the running sports, and maybe that changes now with the shoes. But I think in most sports, there's still a phase two to go. They're not at the level of the marathon, where it is low barrier to entry, extremely globally competitive. There's still a lot to be had by opening access to the sports itself, a ton of improvement to be had in that sense.
Dave Epstein, I know we're out of time, and I got to go improve mine also. So thank you for joining us on ESPN Daily.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
For more Olympics analysis from Dave Epstein, subscribe to his excellent newsletter, The Range Report, at davidepstein.com. Okay, up next, what's been missing from these Olympics and the joy of how they filled that void.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot. Taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Here's another story I want you to know. Look, there is no mincing words here. Competing in a crowdless Olympics, thanks to Japan's pandemic state of emergency, looks and sounds like a tremendous bummer. Because arenas here in the States are once again packed, as we saw with last night's NBA draft, for instance. But the fans and friends and families of Olympians have been barred from the Tokyo Games entirely, which means that those fans and friends and families have been gathering very loudly and very remotely all across the world for virtual Olympic watch parties, just like this one in Orlando for American swimmer Caleb Dressel, who won gold live on NBC in the 100-meter free.
His mom can't even bear to watch. There is his wife, Megan. His dad.
Now, these watch parties are not a new phenomenon. We live in Zoom world, after all, and Milwaukee's Deer District was also looking like that rave in the Matrix during the NBA Finals. I get it. But there is something about the vibes of a very random outpost in, like, Seward, Alaska, population 2,700 that gets to collectively freak out on television as Lydia Jacoby's entire high school cafeteria did when she shocked everyone by taking gold in the breaststroke this week.
10 meters left. Lydia Jacoby, the 17-year-old from Alaska, is putting on the surge of her career. And Lydia Jacoby is going to win gold for the United States.
But my favorite scene of all was the rented out event center in St. Paul, Minnesota, full of the fans and friends and family of gymnast Suni Lee, who we profiled with Alyssa Roenick on this show on Monday. And Suni is many things: the first Hmong American in Olympic history, the best practitioner of the uneven bars in the world, and now, with the withdrawal of her good friend Simone Biles, the last best hope for Team USA. But Suni is also the daughter of John Lee, the man who helped her fall in love with gymnastics, who built her a wooden balance beam in their backyard, who spent countless hours with her year after year in the gym, in the car, cheering and chatting and crying, convincing her to keep competing, even after he was paralyzed in an accident 2 years ago. And so there was John Lee yesterday, right in the middle of that scene in St. Paul, cheering on his daughter from far away as Suni won gold in the women's all-around finals.
13.6.
There is no question that Suni would have wanted her family to be there in person. But there was something beautiful about a watch party on the opposite side of the world from Tokyo that was cheering and chatting and crying and celebrating, reminding Suni Lee what is waiting for her back home. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Mike Philbrick, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Andre Soto, Christian Gardner, Jim Briggs, and Jackson Ugello. I'll talk to you Monday.